On this prequel episode, we've got our Hogfather fan poll follow-up, we're learning about nostalgia bait remakes, and previewing How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Hello and welcome back to This Film Is Lit, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. Well, now it's our real Christmas episode. Last week was our pre-Christmas episode with the Hogfather.
It was our Hogs Watch episode.
And this is will be our real Christmas episode coming up. We will reveal which of the Grinch adaptations we'll be talking about, although it's already been announced on social media if you follow us there. And we'll learn a little bit about that film. But before we get to that, we have to do what we always do, which is thank our beautiful patrons. We have 4 new patrons this week. Well, 3 new patrons and 1 upgraded patron. And they are at the $5 Hugo award-winning level, giving them access to all of our bonus content. James Staub, I'm going to guess is how that's pronounced. S-T-A-A-B. Stabe? Staub? Let us know. And then we have an upgrade from the $2 to the $5 Hugo award-winning level for Gary French. So thank you to both of you for joining us at the $5 level and getting access to that bonus content. And then at the $2 Newbery Medal award-winning level, we have Caleb and Netta. So thank you, Caleb and Netta, for supporting us over on Patreon. You get access to early releases of the episode, which come out the night before. You get the access to the upcoming post that Katie puts on Patreon to let you know what we're going to be doing. Yeah, and you get access to ad-free, which is not a thing yet. But if it ever is, you'll be ad-free. So thank you all very much. And as always, we have our Academy Award-winning patrons, and they are Paul, Kat Insminger, Ben Wilcox, Jeff Niederhofer, Ian from Wine Country, Winchester's Forever, Kelly Napier, Gray Hightower, Eli Youngs, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Says More Sci-Fi Please, V. Frank, and Alina Starkov. Thank you all so very much for continuing to support our show. We appreciate it. Gratch, I'm going to need you to change your name, although you missed it. It should have been this one. You could do next one still. It's right there for the taking. That's all I'm going to say. Put it together and change your name for 1 week or 2 weeks. All right. It's now time to see what you all had to say about Hogfather.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
All right, so on our Patreon, we had 2 votes for the book, 0 for the movie. Winchester's Forever said, "First, I want to thank you for giving this recommendation a chance, although I almost feel I should apologize given how much Brian seemed to dislike watching it."
I didn't entirely dislike watching it, just to clarify. I just found a lot of it very frustrating. I liked quite a bit about it, but also disliked quite a bit about it, so...
I suppose that...
You don't need to apologize, I guess was my point. Sorry.
Yes. I suppose that, thinking back on it, the first time I watched it, I was also more than a little confused by the plot in general, but I'm the kind of person that tends to just let things like that wash over me, and I was not having to watch it in order to analyze it for a podcast, so I can definitely see where others would find the flow of the story more a source of frustration than I did.
I think that's an interesting point, that does, I do find that when I'm watching something for this show, or even for Good, Bad, or Bad, Bad, the ability, that kind of stuff annoys me even more.
Yeah.
Because I have to then go talk about it.
Yes.
And it's very hard to talk about it if I feel like I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's something I don't have to talk about, it's a little bit easier to just be like, whatever. So I think it's an interesting point.
That being said, I hadn't actually read the book this movie was adapted from until just before this podcast. And though I have to give my vote to the book, because there was so much more in the book that made the story I knew so well from the movie that much better, and because nothing will ever beat Pratchett's prose, I still stand by this movie as one of my favorite Christmas movies. Not because it's particularly good or particularly clear, but because the message that it sends is so powerful. And even though it is not the best possible adaptation of the source material, I love it because it is something that, unlike the book, I can actively share with my friends and family every year.
Mm-hmm. If I had somebody there explaining when I asked questions, I don't think I would have enjoyed it just fine. I still think I would have been frustrated, but by some of it. But anyways, yeah, absolutely.
So thank you again for
thank you, Winchesters.
Recommendation, Winchesters. I really enjoyed the book. I also enjoyed the movie, but I did enjoy the book more. On Facebook, we had 3 votes for the book and 0 for the movie. Julie said, having read and loved the book, I enjoyed the movie, especially hearing all my favorite bits of dialogue from the book. Having said that, I can understand Brian's frustration with the movie and agree with most of the criticisms. I would have liked to see more of Death's interactions with the mall kids. They are the best part of the book. Happy Hogs Watch, you two.
I mean, that was a fun little scene in the movie. Yeah,
there is definitely more of that. Like, we see him interact with more kids in the book.
It was definitely a fun scene.
But they did pick, like, the best interaction for the movie.
Yeah.
Adam said, Discworld / Pratchett are a special interest of mine, but I'll do my best to restrain myself from commenting with too much of an essay. No contest vote for the book from me. I wish I could say I was the kind of person Brian was looking for who enjoys this movie on its own merit, because I do enjoy this movie. I recognize, though, I only enjoy it because I enjoy the book so much. It's a standard holiday rotation movie for us, but I can't separate it out from the book enough to say I like it objectively. Everything I do like the most about the movie are the bits pulled verbatim from the book, rising apes, falling angels, that will be an important lesson, etc., and all the places I feel like it fell flat are where they went off and made changes to try to streamline things. I did do a search for that in poor taste equal opportunity joke on my Kindle version and didn't find it. They really need to leave the jokes to Sir Terry.
More on that later, though.
Yeah, more on that later.
It's controversial now. We'll get to it. But thank you, Adam. I'll talk more about this here in a little bit, specifically after Shelby's comment. But I do think it's one that I would enjoy had I read the book.
Yeah.
But I'll talk about that more here in a second.
Charlene said, no feedback since I hadn't read this or any other Terry Pratchett. Just wanted to share that I didn't bat an eye at the library was an orangutan.
Mm-hmm.
Just shrugged it off as surrealism and moved on.
I mean, it does totally track.
It does track.
Yeah.
Over on Twitter, we had 9 votes for the book, 1 for the movie, and 1 listener who couldn't decide. Matt Nelson, cartoonist dork, said, chose the book, but I have to give a shout out to the film. It's one of my dad's favorite Christmas specials, and he watches it every year.
It sounds like your dad maybe hasn't read the book, or maybe he has. I don't know. It just because you said you chose the book, it's one of my dad's favorite Christmas. It made me think that maybe your dad hasn't read the book. We're going to interview your dad on this podcast and see if he understands the story.
All right. Look forward to that. Kelly Napier said, another podcast I listen to that talks about movies often asks, could this be remade as a 10-episode Netflix show? I didn't read, I didn't watch, but it sounds like this would be a good candidate for that to maybe give more time to fully explain the lore of the world.
I think it's well known that my opinion is that everything would be better suited as a 10-episode Netflix series than as a movie. Not everything. Almost every book, though, would be better suited as a TV adaptation than as a film adaptation.
And I think definitely something like Discworld, where there is a lot of lore just baked into it.
Yeah.
You definitely need more space to play with that.
Yeah, for sure.
Shelby Suderman said, this might just be a case of me being able to follow the movie because I've read the book, but I'm going with the movie. Between this and Hitchhiker's Guide, I just don't think this style of satirical adventure story is my thing. I liked the design, especially of Death's home, and I thought the cast did a wonderful job of elevating their characters from the page. That said, I do like your idea of making the movie focus on Susan and Death's relationship, because it is the most interesting part. I read the scene where the kids catch their father as the Hogfather, as that they were going to catch the real Hogfather, but because he's disappearing, he's less real, so they catch their dad. I got the sense from the book that Tea Time's character is what you'd get if the creepy murderous kid archetype was taken in by the Assassin's Guild and given a more constructive outlet, but he's still off-putting and the other assassins don't really like him. I don't think that came across in the movie.
I think it did. I don't know if that came across. I clearly didn't come across in our discussion, but actually that is pretty much exactly the vibe I got of him. And it did seem like the other, like the Assassin Guild leader at the beginning doesn't seem really fond of him in particular.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that it, like that aspect of it, like the other assassins not really liking him.
We don't really
him.
See many other assassins, to be fair, because it seems like all the rest of the people on his team aren't assassins. They're just like henchmen that he's hired, is what it seemed like to me, at least in the movie. They don't seem like members of the Assassin
Guild. No, yeah, they are just like henchmen.
Yeah.
I don't know if that came across like quite as strongly in the movie as it does in the book. Because we do get some of the head assassin's thoughts in the book. So we hear him thinking about, like, well, if he fails, then we don't have to be around him anymore.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, yeah, we definitely don't get that level of it in the book. But I did get a general vibe for whatever reason that he was, was a bit of an outcast even within the Assassin's Guild.
Yeah. Here's the controversy.
Controversy.
Shelby says, the weird equal opportunity line was in the book. I remember it because I had to go back and make sure I didn't misunderstand what it said. So we have conflicting reports.
Conflicting
now.
Reports. We have to get to the bottom of this, Katie. I need you to go back next week.
Maybe Shelby can tell us exactly
if you know
what the line was or where it is.
Because it's possible that maybe a very similar line and that.
Yeah, maybe it's not verbatim.
When Adam, like, control F searched it or whatever, couldn't find the exact words.
Yeah.
So, but the same basic line is in there or something.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's
probably
what I'm assuming.
Happened. But I need to know.
Yeah, we got to find it.
On Instagram, we had five.
Sorry, I wanted to. I just reel back, going back to. I had a point that I wanted to discuss with Shelby's because she specifically mentioned hitchhikers and it triggered a thing in me. No, I mean, like, it just triggered a thought, not like not like it triggered me. She said that this might have been the case of me being able to follow the movie more because I've read the book, but I'm going to go with the movie. And then mentioning Hitchhiker's Guide made me think of this. My controversial decision to choose Hitchhiker's Guide, the film.
Perhaps our most controversial decision.
I will
podcast.
Say that I do think that it's very possible and likely that somebody could have a similar experience watching the Hitchhiker's Guide movie that I had watching this movie.
Yeah.
Of things not really adding up. But because I know the source material so well in that regard, I've read that book a handful of times. Not like I'm an expert, but I've read it enough times that I'm very familiar with the plot of the first Hitchhiker's Guide. And I know, like, what's going on. I know all the characters and all that sort of stuff. That the movie could streamline things and do different things in a way that I found really interesting and enjoyable. And I don't have to worry about, like, making sense of the plot because I know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if for that reason, similarly, if people would have, because the movie wasn't particularly, like, well reviewed when it came out. It wasn't like bagged on in it, and it had like middling, like audience reviews. But it's not seen as like a beloved classic the way like the Lord of the Rings movies are or anything like that. So I do think that it might be interesting that it might be this type of story that if having read it, you're able to parse it reading it, and then the movie, it has a hard time making that story make sense. I don't know. I could be wrong because, again, my experience watching the movie wasn't of confusion. In the Hitchhiker's Guide case, because I had read the book. I don't know. That was just, I think there might be an interesting comparison there. I think there might be a similar thing.
Yeah. Well, going and that wasn't a good one to get, like, that kind of judgment from me either, because I had read Hitchhiker's
Guide. Yes, you had also read the, yes.
I just didn't reread it for that
episode. Yeah, you didn't reread it. So you had at least enough background knowledge that it wasn't going to, like, completely blindside you.
I had at least some, like, background static going on.
It's also possible that just that movie isn't as confusing as I found this. It's also just possible that the Hitchhiker's Guide movie is a little bit, and to my memory, thinking about it, comparing them, the narrative is a little more straightforward. It doesn't seem quite as confusing when I think back on it as Hogfather is, but especially the way Hogfather is presented in the film. Anyways, I just thought that was interesting because I do think it's that same kind of thing where, because Shelby, you know, was talking about how, like, after listening to me bag on the movie in the episode, and she knew that she was going to pick the movie, I actually think that it could. That could be a totally reasonable and defensible position in the same way that I think I could defend picking Hitchhiker's Guide movie.
Yeah.
Although upon rewatching and rereading, I may not pick it. I said that at the time that I, like, if I thought about it and did it again, I might not pick the movie. But anyways, I just wanted to mention that because I thought that was her picking the film was interesting and I wanted to parallel that to Hitchhiker's Guide.
So on Instagram, we had 5 votes for the book, 1 for the movie. R. Sinicky said, "No movie will get close to Pratchett level of genius, but they did their best, and I love to revisit it every year." Mm-hmm. And Lasagna Lasenga said, "The movie is good, but you can't improve perfection." So fair I feel enough. Like the common theme was like, we like the movie, yeah, but the book is better.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me that the people, and I bet that's why it tends to have fairly good reviews on like IMDb and stuff, is that I bet a lot of the people who seek it out to watch it have seen or have read the book.
Yeah.
And it seems like people who have read the book are like, yeah, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good adaptation. Like, it's not bad. And thus, because they've read the book, don't have the same experience that I have had of being very confused. Mm-hmm. So it tracks. It makes sense.
So our ultimate winner was a bit of a landslide. Mm-hmm. This time it was the book with 19 votes to the movie's 2 plus 1 undecided listener.
1 undecided. All right. Thank you all very much for your feedback. If you want to do that next time, just follow us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, any of those places, and look out for the posts asking for your feedback every 2 weeks after we release our main episode. All right, now it's time for us to learn a little bit about nostalgia bait remakes.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world.
Okay, so I thought this might be an interesting topic to mm-hmm. discuss because over the past decade or so, it does feel like there's been an uptick in nostalgic remakes.
There's definitely been an uptick.
Yeah, both in film and in television.
Yeah, I do tend to, in general, push back against the sort of cultural idea that like, oh, there's nothing new anymore. Everything's just remakes and sequels.
Oh, like, I don't buy into
no,
that.
No, I know you don't. I know you don't. And I know that's not what you're saying. I just wanted to clarify. I think I push back about the narrative because we've had remakes forever. We've had sequels yeah. forever. And we still have tons of really great, new, interesting stuff. You're just not seeking it out in the way that, you know, because the market is saturated by other things. Mm-hmm. I get it. I get some of the complaint a little bit. But that being said, I think it is still probably definitely true. I obviously would have to do some sort of analysis here to see numbers wise. I think it's very likely true, though, that there has been an uptick in remakes and specifically right, yeah. nostalgia baiting yeah. remakes in the past 10, 20 years.
Yeah. So, and I think part of the reason that we've noticed it happening so much is because there have been like some thematic similarities in those remakes throughout this past decade. Like a lot of them have been like either these like dark, gritty, like more quote unquote adult kind of offerings. Mm-hmm. Like I was thinking about shows like Riverdale or like The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Yeah. I guess Riverdale's not really a remake so much as it is just an adaptation though, right? Because it's just an adaptation yeah, of the Archie comics, but
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, I'm using terms a little bit loosely okay. here. So we've got like that kind of offering, and then we've also got ones that have been largely considered like unimaginative cash grabs,
right?
Like most of Disney's recent yeah, live action remakes.
Yeah.
Haven't been considered incredibly creative on the whole.
No. I've seen none of them, so I can't comment, but yeah.
I mean, a lot of the big ones I thought Cinderella was fine.
It's the only one I've seen, I think.
Well, you've seen Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, true. We watched it for the podcast.
Which I think kicked off that more of like shot for shot yes. remake. Trend.
It was fine, but it was also very much just following the very similar yeah. formula to what the original did.
Yeah. And then all of their like villain backstory stuff where they keep giving us like every villain but the one anyone cares about seeing a backstory for.
Well, we don't know yet. It's coming out still.
Have they announced an Ursula movie? Because I missed that.
Oh, movie. Sorry. I thought you just meant expanding their backstory in the within the main movie.
No, I mean, that's fair. There is going to be a Little Mermaid adaptation. There's going to be a Little Mermaid coming out. So maybe we'll get more Ursula content.
And my guess would be that if that's successful, that's when you would get the Ursula standalone film. You know what I mean? They wouldn't do that before the live action Little Mermaid remake.
Yeah, I guess so.
But they might do it after. Who knows? Anyways, sorry.
I just don't feel excited about any of it.
No, I don't either. Not in particular, but...
But I do think it is important to remember, as you said, that an influx of these, like, recycled nostalgic properties is not a new phenomenon. The popularity of films and TV shows and properties like this tends to ebb and flow just like any other trend does.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now we're probably at the tail end of that. It's been a while, and I think people are largely tired of it.
I agree. It does.
I think it's going to start to trend out.
It does seem like, you know, like you said, the excitement for, like, the Disney remakes is very much waning.
Yeah.
It's at least waning in the cultural discussion. I don't know how much it's waning in ticket sales, which is all they care about anyways.
That's fair.
So, but yeah, I haven't looked at, like, the box, you know, but I would imagine it also, COVID makes it tough to know in terms of, like, box office and stuff, how that's, I would be interested to see what the box office for, like, when Little Mermaid comes out, I think next year or whatever, how that does compared to, like, Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin or whatever.
So I wanted to talk about this because 2000's How the Grinch Stole Christmas went out in the polls, and that was a nostalgic, you could call it an adaptation, we could call it a remake, that fell, like, smack into the middle of another cycle of that type of film when that really reigned supreme. So I want to dig a little bit into that. Before I get into that era of films, I want to give credit to YouTuber Modern Girl's video, The Rise and Fall of a Forgotten Film Genre, What is Kinder Camp? So she put out this video a few weeks ago, and I had never heard of the genre before.
I've never heard of it.
I think she coined the name Kinder Camp herself, because I Googled it, and I didn't find anything other than her video using that term.
Okay.
So I thought it would make for an interesting segment.
Putting memes out into the universe.
And as per the usual, what I'm going to give you here is more of a Cliff Notes overview of the topic. Her video is very well researched, much more in depth than this is going to be, so you should definitely go check that out. So this period of film started in the early to mid 90s with film adaptations of nostalgic television properties like The Addams Family and The Flintstones. Notice that this trend also reflects the 30-year trend cycle with popular nostalgic properties from the 60s and then later on the 70s being revived in the 90s and the 2000s, similar to how a lot of what has been rebooted recently reflects 90s nostalgia.
And in late 80s.
And then the genre started to peter out in the mid to late 2000s with flops like Bewitched, Speed Racer, Yogi Bear. Do we even remember any of those?
Yes. So supposedly, and I have not seen it, but I have heard tell that Speed Racer is maybe gotten a bad rap for.
You think so?
I've never seen it. I have not either. I know nothing about it. But I have heard somebody, who was I watching recently? I was watching some YouTube video or something talking about, and Speed Racer came up about how it is a very interesting and faithful adaptation of Speed Racer. And because it is so faithful, it does, like, it just, people weren't prepared for what it was because they didn't remember what Speed Racer was actually like. And that movie is basically, I don't remember what I was watching, but somebody was talking about that. Because it was in reference to, I think, something discussing, because it was the Wachowskis did that. And they were discussing, and maybe something to do with the Matrix one, the sequel coming up or something like that. Anyways, supposedly that is maybe actually a better movie than people remember.
It'll get a little bit of, because what's interesting about this genre too is that a lot of the films, even like at its peak, were like kind of critical flops,
yeah,
but did well at the box office, yeah, and are remembered very fondly by like people who were younger when they were coming out.
Right.
So maybe that one will get its due.
Maybe. I don't know. The other two I forgot were made completely, entirely.
So a couple defining features of this genre. I've got like kind of three main big ones here. The first one is an outlandish high production design, especially in regard to the sets and the costumes. I don't know if you've ever seen the Flintstones movie.
Oh, yes, I have.
But regardless of anything else you could say about it, and you could say a lot,
yeah,
it looks like the cartoon come to life.
Yeah.
Like the production value on it is insane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I don't remember much about it. I remember seeing it as a kid and enjoying it as much as I remember enjoying anything like that as a kid. But I bet it does not hold up. I bet
I'm sure it doesn't.
Oof, I bet. And I say it doesn't hold up. It was not well received at the time by a lot of people. But as a kid, like, I remember enjoying it moderately as a kid. But I bet it does. If I watch it now, I'd be like, oh,
we had that movie on VHS, and my sister liked to watch it. She would have been like, like five, maybe.
Yeah.
I should rewatch that with her and see what she thinks.
Yeah, that
of it
came
now.
Out in like 96 or something.
It was like 94, I think. But we had it on VHS in like the early aughts.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's a good example of this type of like production value. It was a very like maximalist, candy colored, Technicolor, very camp approach.
Yeah. Which I actually, like I said, I actually kind of appreciate them leaning into.
Yeah,
I bet a lot of the jokes don't hold up and stuff, and I'm sure this is not a very good movie, but I like leaning into, you're going to make an adaptation of this weird, swacky cartoon. Just do it.
Just do it, just man. Do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Another defining feature is the addition of, like, themes, plot elements, and jokes that were often geared towards adults, but usually still worked for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And my last one is the use of satirical humor that often commented on social issues, right? Topical issues. So while this era was mostly defined by adaptations of previous properties, adaptations or remakes, some examples also trade on nostalgia-driven original stories that used familiar tropes to satirize other familiar genres. For example, Shrek's takedown of the Disney fairy tale formula falls quite nicely into that.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the reason that I found this so interesting as I was watching her YouTube video is that the presence of this style of film was like definitely not something that I noticed or would have noticed at the time.
Yeah.
But also not something I'd ever thought about. But then once it was brought to my attention, like looking back, there was definitely a very clearly defined genre that was formulated around this type of like nostalgic campy remake.
Yeah. Another one that you didn't mention that I just thought of was the Scooby-Doo movies.
Yeah.
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 Which are, I believe I've heard one of them is at least kind of good. James Gunn wrote.
First one was
James
good.
Gunn wrote one of them.
I haven't seen either.
I don't
of those
know
in
which
a very
one.
Long
he was
time.
A writer on one of them, and I've heard the one he worked on or wrote. I thought I've heard was pretty good. It might have been the first one. I don't know. I've never seen any of them, but yeah.
And like in looking back, I think most of us are probably inclined to look at that era nostalgically, as you do.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely remember people at the time registering the exact same complaints that you hear now.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, nobody has original ideas anymore. Hollywood isn't creative. All anybody can do is remake what's already been done.
Yeah.
And like, honestly, in comparing this era to today's lineup of remakes, I do feel like maybe I would prefer if we went back to this type of like wild, campy, escapist adaptation. I think maybe we're all a little bit burnt out on like the cynical remake. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, I think we're definitely burnt out on the cynical remake because I don't think anybody was ever not burnt out on it. It's inherent in it being a cynical remake.
Yeah.
I mean, the cynicism, like, it's clear, like, that being said, I do think that there's, I agree that the I think it would be interesting to see some more of that again, of leaning in to, if we're going to do remakes, really lean into them. I bet we,
yeah, I'm like, trying to like lean into the spirit of the original thing.
Yeah.
I feel like the one example that I'm thinking of, and we didn't watch this and I don't know if you'll even know what I'm talking about, was the Netflix adaptation of the Winx Club, which was a cartoon.
No, in the early 2000s,
but it was very like the cartoon itself. I didn't really watch. I was not a Winx Club girl. I was a witch girl. If you know, you know. But the cartoon was a very like candy colored, like bright, like magical girl show. And then Netflix remade it and they gave it like the Riverdale Sabrina treatment. Yeah, yeah. And everybody hated it.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what something like that could have looked like had they leaned into the spirit of the original thing, you know?
Yeah, and that's what it boils down to, is that producers and the people who greenlight movies and TV shows are always trying to chase the thing that was just made a lot of money. Like, that's always what it is. And so if it, you know, at the time when Winx Club got greenlit, Chilling Tales of Sabrina was probably in its peak of popularity after the first two seasons or whatever, which actually we watched Chilling Tales. And both quite liked it. I thought it kind of decreased.
It took a nosedive.
It decreased a little bit. in quality over the seasons. But the first season
the first season I really
was
amazing.
It was really, really good. And the second season was pretty good. And they kind of progressively got a little less enjoyable as they went. But they weren't. I don't think they ever got bad necessarily. Just less good.
Well, and even I think the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina was a little bit camp.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's like goth camp.
Yes, but it does lean into some camp and stuff, but it is still, you know, compared to Sabrina of
like the
90s or, Sabrina TV show, like it's very much a different aesthetic and feel. And so I think it's just a matter of and so they were leaning into that. And I think the problem is that it's just because I think like a gritty reboot can work if it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's just you have to have people who understand the property enough to really, you know, to lean into what it is that people like about that property and just do that. Like we talked about with Dune, it just like sort of focusing on what it is that people like about Dune. And Denis Villeneuve was like, it's the poetry and it's this world, these visuals and these characters, and just focusing on that. And so I do think that, but that being said, I think there is definitely a prominent, and this has always been the case, but there's a prominent streak within the film and TV industry to, like I said, just chase what just made money.
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless of whether or not that makes sense for the property you're currently working on. So yeah, if Winx Club should have been more like Jim and the Holograms or whatever, the cartoon or whatever, and then they ended up, you know, trying to shoehorn it into a Chilling Tales of Sabrina.
Yeah.
Shaped hole, that's not gonna work. It's just make the shows the way, you know, that they should be made, which seems is obvious and redundant and silly. Like, do it right is like the least helpful feedback ever, but yeah, I get what you're saying for sure.
So what do you guys think? I want to hear all the feedback. What do we think of remakes then? What do we think of remakes now?
Mm-hmm.
Etc.
Do you want another Flintstones movie? That's what I want to know. I do. same actors and everything. Bring John Goodman. What's his name? Oh, he's not acting.
Yeah,
anymore,
Rick Moranis isn't acting anymore. Moranis isn't acting
anymore. Coming out of retirement for the Flintstones movie sequel. Didn't they make a sequel?
I have no idea, actually.
I thought they made a sequel.
Because, yeah, the plot of that. The plot of that.
I thought they made a sequel.
He gets a job as an executive because the bad guy is going to make him, like, he's going to embezzle a bunch of money and make Fred his, like, fall guy. And then Halle Berry tries to seduce him.
Yep.
And it's very adult.
Yep. They did make a sequel, but it was one of those sequels where they recast everybody because nobody wanted to come back.
Rip.
So literally, and it's like the who's who of, like, oh no. Well, that's not true. But yeah, they recast everybody. So like Fred Flintstone is played by a guy named Mark Addy, which he's been in stuff, but Barney Rubble was played by Stephen Baldwin, which is hilarious. And Betty was played by Jane Krakowski. But yeah, everybody was recast, at least all of the main four characters. I don't know if any of the other, but yeah, Flintstones in Viva Rock Vegas. And it came out 6 years later.
That does strike a memory bell in me. But I think it is technically a sequel.
It's the same director.
Huh.
And it looks very similar. I don't know if I ever saw it, but like it went for the same style as the first movie. But yeah, they couldn't get John Goodman back. He was like, no, thank you.
I'm good.
All right. It's time now for us to learn a little bit about the book, How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Universal Pictures and Imagine Entertainment invite you to experience the magic of the classic story as it comes to life like you've never seen before. In a place where the Christmas spirit is everywhere.
Have the best Christmas ever!
Well, almost everywhere.
Counting down the Christmas clock, old young baseball.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas, exclamation mark. There is an exclamation mark on the title. Is a children's story written and illustrated by Theodore Dr. Seuss Geisel, written in rhymed verse, as he did. The book's illustrations consist of black, white, and reds and pinks. The Grinch's now signature green color was actually the invention of the 1966 animated TV adaptation.
It's one of those things that I read as a fun fact for my movie, for the movie version we're doing, which is the 2000 version, that they decided to keep, you know, just went obviously with the green.
Yeah.
Because it is, as much as it is an adaptation of the book, this 2000 version is basically a remake slash adaptation of the 1966 version. But it's so funny because I had read the book as a kid, clearly, at least once or twice. But my cultural memory of it is so directly tied to the 1966 animated version that finding out that he wasn't green in the original artwork kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
I was like, wait a second, what? And it was one of those things where it's like, I bet this is one of those things on the Mandela effect list.
Oh,
of
yeah.
Like, you know,
I bet you could convince a bunch of people that this was a Mandela effect thing.
Yeah, 100%. They're like, no, he was green in the original book. Like, no, just like
he really
black.
Wasn't.
No, just like black and white. Yeah, people would not believe it.
The Grinch is also the first adult and the first villain to be a main character in a Dr. Seuss book.
Mm-hmm.
The story was published as a book by Random House in 1957. It also was published at approximately the same time in an issue of Red Book, which is a women's magazine. The story criticizes the commercialization of Christmas and the holiday season, in case you forgot that.
Yeah, in case you forgot the point of How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
The character of the Grinch actually first appeared in a 33-line illustrated poem by Dr. Seuss called The Hubbub and the Grinch, which was originally published in the May 1955 edition of Red Book. Dr. Seuss began to work on How the Grinch Stole Christmas a few years later, around the beginning of 1957. His wife, Helen, acted as an unofficial editor, as she had with previous Dr. Seuss books. Dr. Seuss claimed that he was the inspiration for the character, as his wife's health problems and his dismay with the commercialization of Christmas made him feel, quote, very Grinchish?
That is tough to say.
Grinchish. He was quoted as saying,
I would have said very Grinchy instead of ish, but sure.
But that's why you're not Dr. Seuss.
Fair enough.
He was quoted as saying,
better than Dr. Seuss.
I was brushing my teeth on the morning of the 26th of last December when I noticed a very Grinchish countenance in the mirror. It was Seuss. So I wrote about my sour friend, the Grinch, to see if I could rediscover something about Christmas that I'd obviously lost.
To be fair, I think we're all a little bit of a Grinch on the 26th.
That's true.
I don't want to say it's when your Christmas spirit's at an all-time low, but it is, you know, sort of like there's the immediate letdown
It's like the worst Sunday ever.
Yeah, it's that hangover, you know. Yeah. You're like, oh, you know, you have this lovely month or whatever of lead up where you're all in the spirit, and then, you know, the 26th, you're like, oh god, I guess real life's still a thing.
The book was well received. M.S. Libby, writing in the New York Herald Tribune, compared the book favorably to Dr. Seuss's earlier works, stating, "His peculiar and original genius in line and word is always the same, yet so rich are the variations he plays on his theme, always fresh and amusing." Kirkus Reviews wrote, "Youngsters will be in transports over the goofy gaiety of Dr. Seuss's first book about a villain."
Be in transports?
That's what the quote said.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
I've never heard that
It's a 1950s phrase, I guess.
I mean, I can context clue it out, but, you know, I'm assuming it just means, like, you know, in stitches or, like, overjoyed or whatever. But in transports, I've never heard that.
The reviewer also called the Grinch, quote, "easily the best Christmas cad since Scrooge." I don't know what other Christmas cads there are.
I would say that those are the main two. So,
based on,
I guess the other big one is what's his name from? Is he? I'm just trying to remember. It's been so long since I've seen the movie. And It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, the
guy, the town, not the mayor, but
the banker.
The banker.
Is he a banker? I don't know. Oh, no, he's the guy who's, like, buying everything.
Yeah,
I don't remember his name.
And now I'm blank. Oh, it's got such a good name. It's got Jimmy Stewart is very upset at him. I don't remember. I haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life in so long.
Who's the bad guy in It's a Wonderful
Baker?
Life?
No.
Oh, no, it's Mr. Potter.
Potter. Because Pottersville. I was thinking Bakersville. Pottersville. Yes. Potter. Mr. Potter. That would be the other one I could think of. And I don't even know if he doesn't like Christmas. It's so much as just, like, is an asshole during Christmas.
Well, he was ruining Christmas. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Grinch and Scrooge are also just assholes during Christmas.
No, but they also actively dislike Christmas.
I guess you're right.
They, like, actively are like, Christmas sucks. I don't know. I just don't know about Mr. Potter if he feels that way.
Somebody tell us.
Somebody tell us.
Based on a 2007 online poll, the National Education Association listed the book as one of its teachers' top 100 books for children. In 2012, it ranked 61st among the top 100 picture books in a survey by School Library Journal, and it was the fourth of five Dr. Seuss books on that list. The titular character, as well as a few other characters from the story, have also appeared in the 1977 animated special Halloween is Grinch Night, the 1982 animated special The Grinch Grinches the Cat in the Hat,
God,
the children's show The Wubulous World of Dr. Seuss, and Seussical the Musical.
Uh-huh.
Since the book was written, the word Grinch has entered the popular lexicon as an informal noun, usually defined as a killjoy or a spoilsport.
Yep. In the same vein as Scrooge.
Yes.
Although Scrooge is a little more specifically Christmas-related, but not necessarily. It doesn't have to be, but it's very often more Christmas-related, whereas Grinch is a little more broadly,
at least in my head. A smidge, I think.
Yeah, like Grinch is used kind of
but
more commonly across.
But they're definitely used in pretty much the same way.
Yes.
In the popular lexicon.
Yes.
And aside from the 2000 film adaptation that we'll be discussing, the book has also been adapted as the aforementioned 1966 animated TV special, a 2007 stage musical, a 13-minute song in 2013, and a 2018 3D animated feature. And there are also several audio and audiovisual versions of the book. And speaking of, the 2000 film did win in our listener's choice. It won pretty handily. The only place it had any kind of competition was Twitter, for some reason. but if you really had your heart set on the 2018 version, then you should be pleased to hear that we will be discussing that film on our Patreon as our December bonus episode. And bonus Patreon episodes are available starting at the $5 per month level, and we will not be offended if you just want to jump on for 1 month to get that one.
Stick around for a month if that's fine. You can do that whenever there's something. If you want to come in for a month, listen to the thing. As long as you let the payment go through for that month, totally good. Which I think it goes through as soon as you sign up. So
yeah,
totally fine. All right, it's now time to learn a little bit more about the aforementioned 2000 film, How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Jim Carrey is...
The Grinch! I must stop this Christmas from coming!
From Universal Pictures.
What would I wear? Ho-ho!
And Imagine Entertainment.
I forgot about the reindeer. Action! Brilliant!
Mr. Grinch? I myself am having some Yuletide doubts.
Don't care.
Maybe if you can reunite with the Who's and be a part of Christmas.
Maybe if you can reunite with the Who's and be a part of Christmas.
Grow up!
If you think you know the whole story.
What if it's all just a misunderstanding?
This could change my entire outlook on life.
Really?
No.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas is a 2000 film directed by Ron Howard, known for Apollo 13, A Beautiful Mind, Cinderella Man, The Da Vinci Code, Willow, and many others. Director-wise, obviously known for Happy Days as an actor, among other things. And written by Jeffrey Price and Peter S. Seaman, known for Wild Wild West. They're a writer's team. Everything I could find, they had all identical credits.
Good for them.
They literally write everything together. Known for Wild Wild West, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Last Holiday, and Shrek the Third. The film stars Anthony Hopkins, Jim Carrey, Josh Ryan Evans, Kelly as Max, that's the dog, Frank Weller, Christine Baranski, Landry Albright, Jeffrey Tambor, Taylor Momsen, Molly Shannon, Mindy Sterling, and Clint Howard. The film has a 49% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 46% on Metacritic, and a 6.2 out of 10 on IMDb. So not very well reviewed.
Yeah.
Actually, worse reviewed than I would have expected.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would have thought it would have been in like the mid or upper 50s, lower 60s. Like, not good, but like, thought it would have been a little bit higher. Just based on sort of the memory of it. I feel like people kind of like this movie. I don't know. I could be wrong. The film made $345 million against a budget of $123 million. So it was very expensive, but it made quite a bit of money. In July of 1998, Audrey Geisel... widow of Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel. Her agent announced via letter that she would be auctioning the film rights for How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And so in order to pitch their ideas to Geisel, the suitors ultimately had to be willing to do a bunch of stuff, but pay $5 million for the material and hand over 4% of the box office gross, 50% of the merchandising revenue, and music-related material, and 70% of the income from book tie-ins.
Oh, she plays hardball.
Played hardball on that one. To me, it very much felt like, we're going to go on here. This is what's really interesting. Letter also stipulated, any actor submitted to play the Grinch must be of comparable stature to Jack Nicholson, Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, or Dustin Hoffman. Additionally, stipulated that the estate would not consider a director or writer who had not earned at least $1 million on a previous picture. So that very much feels like it was entirely money based. Like Audrey Geisel was like, "I'm here to make money. I don't give a shit. Like, you gotta give me bankable stars. Give me bankable director. I don't care." As long as it makes money.
I think the first part with all the percentages, I think you could read the other stuff as her wanting it to be a success. So that they could make more movies of other properties.
I guess. To me, it seems more like it. I gotta have a.
Could read
yeah,
it that
I guess
way.
You could. I just thought that was interesting. And one of the first pitches was 20th Century Fox pitched a version with Jack Nicholson playing the Grinch, but that was rejected.
Okay, so for anyone who thinks that Jim Carrey playing the Grinch is scary, Jack Nicholson playing the Grinch, that is nightmare fuel.
Terrifying. Terrifying. Universal Pictures then pitched to Geisel with producers Brian Grazer and Gary Ross, but Geisel refused that pitch as well. Grazer then would go on to enlist Ryan Howard, who is one of his producing buddies, and they've worked on a lot of stuff together, to help with the pitch. Howard, who went then and studied the book so that he could go pitch to Geisel, became super interested in the character of Cindy Lou Who and ended up pitching a film in which she would have a much larger role, as well as a materialistic representation of the Whos and an expanded backstory of the Grinch. And this is ultimately what Geisel would agree to. And on September 16th, 1998, it was announced that Ron Howard would direct and co-produce a live-action adaptation of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and that Jim Carrey would be attached to star. So it's funny that two of the pitches literally had two of the actors. Was like one of these four or somebody comparable. But it's like, just find one, get one of those four. Like it's. Although Dustin Hoffman makes no sense to me.
Out of those four, it would have to be Jim Carrey. Yeah,
makes the most
because
sense.
Jack Nicholson is too scary. Dustin Hoffman doesn't make any sense. Robin Williams is too nice.
Yeah, I could see Robin Williams. It's the only other one that makes any sense to me.
Yeah.
I could see Jack Nicholson. He would maybe be too scary, but I could at least see it. Dustin Hoffman makes literally no sense. Like, literally no sense to me. I just don't see it at all. So, before Ron Howard had signed on to direct the film, Tim Burton was considered to direct, which makes a ton of sense, obviously. He's done... didn't he go on to do... He's done something, Seuss, right? Or has he not?
Who? Tim Burton?
Tim Burton. I guess he maybe hasn't.
I don't... think so.
I don't think he has, but it honestly, it's one of those things that his style would fit very well.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm thinking, I was thinking of, which is not Dr. Seuss. I was thinking of Charlie and Chocolate Factory.
That's Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl. But yeah, I would think Tim Burton's style would fit very well, but he couldn't do it because of scheduling conflicts with one of our very early episodes, Sleepy Hollow. So Geisel had, and this is obviously... not Dr. Seuss, this is the widow Geisel, had final veto power over the script and actually ended up objecting to several jokes in the script and sexual innuendos, including one about a family who did not have a Christmas tree or presents and jokingly called themselves, called the Hoosteens.
Woof.
Yep.
Probably a good job to get rid of that one.
Yep. And a visual gag of the Cat in the Hat's head being mounted on the Grinch's wall, which that one's kind of
fun. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
I mean, I can see why she would veto that, but
right.
That's kind
it's
of kind funny.
Kind of funny, yeah.
The other one would not have aged well.
No. Another callback to a movie we did recently, much of the Whoville set ended up being constructed on the backlot of Universal Studios right behind the Bates Motel set from Psycho.
Hmm.
And it's actually the largest, or at least at the time was the largest set on the Universal Studios lot.
And another example of that kind of like incredible production value.
Yeah.
Like, because the set for this was also... insane.
Yeah, crazy. Yep, absolutely. So Rick Baker, a famed makeup artist, was hired to design and create the prosthetic makeup for Jim Carrey and the rest of the cast. They did a bunch of tests, but ultimately Jim Carrey admired a photo of Baker in the first test makeup that he did for the role, and they went with the decision to use that original makeup design after trying a bunch of different designs. The Grinch suit itself was covered in yak hair, dyed green and then sewn onto a spandex suit. And we'll get into this because this is interesting. But the application of the makeup, and this is from Wikipedia, of the makeup took up to 8.5 hours, after which a frustrated Carrie kicked a hole in the wall of his trailer. Carrie's makeup artist, Kazuhiro, and I assume it means one time it took 8.5 hours, because we'll get to it, because there's a different, I have a different...
There's a different recounting of this later. Yeah.
Carrie's makeup artist, Kazuhiro, said, quote, "On set, Jim Carrey was really mean to everybody, and at the beginning of the production, they couldn't finish. After 2 weeks, we could only finish 3 days worth of shooting schedule, because suddenly he would just disappear, and when he came back, everything was ripped apart. We couldn't shoot anything." Kazu is Japanese, so English is a second language, which is why it's a little...
And I assume by everything was ripped apart, he probably means the prosthetics.
Or his trailer. I don't know. This is just the quote I found. Kazuhiro actually ended up leaving production until Rick Baker and Ron Howard had a discussion with Jim Carrey on how important Kazu was to the production. And Carrey agreed to keep his anger in check. So Kazu returned. And we actually, and that was funny because this Kazuhiro was a name I recognized because mm-hmm. he was a guest judge on an episode of Face Off.
Yeah.
Rick Baker's been on Face Off a couple times, I think, because he's a very, very famous, and, mm-hmm. and so is Kazuhiro, but I didn't realize this was a movie Kazu worked on. But they've both been on Face Off. Rick Baker and V. Neil are like very good friends because they worked on a bunch of stuff together. Counterpoint from this trivia fact, or from this fact that it was on IMDb, or sorry, that was on Wikipedia, this comes from IMDb, supposedly the makeup, according to IMDb, took 2 hours in the morning to get into and 1 hour in the evening to get out of. And according to Jim Carrey, he became a, quote, Zen master while sitting in the makeup chair. Again, this flies very much in the face of the previous... So
what is the truth?
I don't know what the truth is, but I thought that was interesting.
Also, like, if that one is true, like, 2 hours getting in and an hour getting out is not that bad.
No, it's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
No. I mean, 2 hours is a while.
I've sat longer
but...
getting my hair done for dances.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, so the first part of that was that he spent 92 days in the Grinch makeup. So that's, he had to do that 92 times. Like, that,
sure.
He had to do that nonstop for 3 months or whatever, 4 or 5 months. So I could get being a little frustrated, you know, annoyed with it at times. But anyways, yeah, I don't know what the true story is, but I'm sure somebody does. So there's a scene in the movie where the Grinch pulls a sheet or a tablecloth off of the table.
Mm-hmm.
And in the film, or in the script, it was all the silverware was supposed to fall off. But Jim Carrey did such a good job at it that nothing fell off, so he had to go back and he like flips the table or whatever, or he like knocks all the stuff over on the table. I feel like I have a vague memory.
Yeah, I have
of
a vague memory of that.
And, like,
I feel
everything
like
over on the table.
We can look out for that.
Supposedly, that wasn't what was. Yeah, he was supposed to ruin it all, but then when he didn't, he went back and ruined it.
That's funnier anyway.
Yep. So this is interesting. This is the highest grossing Christmas movie since Home Alone.
Hmm.
So 10 years, because Home Alone came out in 1990,
yeah.
But. Which makes sense because Home Alone was huge, and then I can't think of any Christmas movies that would be as big.
I mean, the Santa Claus?
That would have been a probably pretty big one, but not, wouldn't be as, I mean, Home Alone 2, I guess, would be the one, because Home Alone 2 probably made a lot of money, but that would be the only one that other couple that would even get close, I would think. The film did win one Oscar for Best Makeup, going to Rick Baker and Gail Roel Ryan? I don't. It's a hyphenated last name. So getting into some reviews now, because I thought these are always fun and interesting. Paul Clinton of CNN declared that Carrey was, quote, born to play this role, and noted that Carrey carries nearly every scene. In fact, if he's not in the scene, there is no scene. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly said in his review, he analyzed the Grinch's, quote, mischievously divided, now I'm calm, now I'm a raving, sarcastic psycho personality, and summed up Carrey's Grinch as, quote, a slobby, self-loathing elitist ruled by the secret fear that he's always being left out of things. Gleiberman went on to express surprise at, quote, how affecting Carrey makes the Grinch's ultimate big-hearted turnaround as Carrey the actor sneaks up on Carrey the Wild Man Dervish, in whichever mode he carries the movie. I had to include that part because fuck that guy for that review, for his pun. Stupid. Bad. Stephanie Zakaric of Salon had a negative review of the film, writing, quote, Carrey pulls off an admirable impersonation of an animated figure. It's fine as mimicry goes, but mimicry isn't the best playground for comic genius. Shouldn't we be asking more of a man who's very likely the most gifted comic actor of his generation? She concluded that, in spite of a few terrific ad-libs, his jokes come off as nothing more than a desperate effort to inject some offbeat humor into an otherwise numbingly unhip, nonsensical, and just plain dull story.
Wow.
So, scathing indictment. And as always, or at least most of the time, we have to end on Roger Ebert's review of the film. He gave the film 2 out of 4 stars, referring to it as, quote, a dank, eerie, weird movie about a sour creature. So, sure.
I mean, that's kind of what the story is.
That's the point. And said, quote, there should be a jollier production design and a brighter look overall. It's just not much fun.
You know, I am ever more convinced that Roger Ebert doesn't understand film.
Right? It just blows my mind every time I read one of his reviews. And I say that with much love because I know he is a very he died, right?
I don't know.
I think he died. Siskel died a long time ago, but Ebert died recently, right?
I think so. I think you're right.
Because he had cancer. Yeah, he died in 2013. Ebert would go on to observe that Carrey, quote, works as hard as an actor has ever worked in a movie to small avail. But he did finally decide that, quote, adults may appreciate Carrey's remarkable performance in an intellectual sort of way and give him points for what was obviously a supreme effort. So,
well, stay tuned to see if we can appreciate his performance in an intellectual sort of way.
Yeah, and we'll see. We will see. Katie, where can people watch?
Well, as always, you can check your local library. Or if you still have a local video rental store, you can check with them. If not, you can stream this with a subscription through Fubo, DirecTV, Freeform, Sling TV, or Spectrum TV. So it's not really anywhere. Yeah, it's not really anywhere. It's on a lot of like cable providers.
Cable providers, yeah. I think those are all cable, like, or versions of cable providers, basically, I think.
Yeah, Freeform is like a channel, right?
So if it's on Freeform, that's why it's on all those other ones, probably. Because Freeform is a network that's, I think it used to be like ABC Family or whatever.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so that would be why it would be on all those other ones. So Freeform would be the place to look for it wherever you get your Freeform content, it sounds like.
And if you don't get your Freeform content anywhere, you can also rent this for around $3 to $4 through Apple TV, Amazon, YouTube, Vudu, AMC Theaters on Demand, Redbox, or DirecTV.
There you go. That's how you can watch 2000's How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I've seen this movie at least once, if not twice.
I don't think I've seen it since maybe high school, but I have definitely seen it.
Yeah, I think I've seen it a couple times, but like you said, I don't think I've seen it since the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
It's been at least 10 years since I've seen this film. So I am interested to see.
Yeah, very interested to see how this holds up for me.
I remember kind of enjoying it, I feel like, but not as much as the original animated one is my vague memory of like, oh, the animated one's like better, like, but it's fine. Yeah, that's my memory of my feelings, but we'll see. We shall see. And until that time, when we decide whether or not we like this movie, guys, gals, non-binary pals, everybody else,
keep reading books,
keep watching movies,
and keep being awesome.